We intend to finish the chapter tonight. Self-surrendering works the way of the Gita. So he comes to the core of the practice here. And he opens, but by what practical steps of self-discipline can we arrive at this consummation? To be equal to all events. To live in the divine, not in the ego. How do we achieve that? The elimination of all egoistic activity and of its foundation, the egoistic consciousness, is clearly the key to the consummation we desire. And since, in the path of works, action is the knot we have first to loosen, we must endeavor to loosen it where it is centrally tied, in desire and in ego. For otherwise, we shall cut only stray strands and not the heart of our bondage. Now, this is a straightforward way to approach it, and he's using the Greek idea of cutting the Gordian knot and not simply fraying the strands. But that's not the only kind of knot, of course. In the Indian Hatha Yogic tradition, there are three granthis, three knots, that have also to be unloosened. Later, Sri Aurobindo and the mother speak about not so much a slicing through of the knot, but of the unraveling of it, not destroying it so much as to uncoil it so that energies can flow up and down successfully. But here we're talking about getting release from desire and ego, so he's using quite strong language. Desire in Sanskrit is kama, and ego is ahankara, the eye maker. These are the two knots of our subjection to this ignorant and divided nature, desire, and ego sense. We might also note that it's not simply the Gita that so regards the dominance of desire and ego in our nature, but also Buddhism, Jainism, etc. It is really a human phenomenon, is it not? It's not restricted simply to India. And all philosophies, all ethical considerations have thought about how best to control the ego and subject it to a discipline that allows it to work well in the world and lead to the highest possible felicity for the individual. Here, this path doesn't simply want to accord the personal being with a larger context, society, etc., but to lift us out of it, to transcend, to go beyond. So back to desire and ego. And of these two, desire has its native home in the emotions and sensations and instincts, in the prana. And from there, affects thought and volition. So it's based down here and moves upward, not only dominating our action, but has an effect, a clouding effect, an energizing effect sometimes on the mind and on the willpower. Ego sense lives indeed in these movements, but it casts its deep roots also into the thinking mind and its will, and it is there that it becomes fully self-conscious. These are the twin obscure powers of the obsessing worldwide ignorance that we have to enlighten and eliminate. The thinking mind and its will, this would be in the Sankhian scheme of things, the buddhi. But even that is an element of ignorance. It's part of nature. It is not fully enlightened. The only thing that is enlightened is, of course, the purusha, the pure being of the self. So we see here that both desire and ego are part of the cosmic constitution. They're not peculiar only to the individual. They have a raison d'être in the larger scheme of things. In the field of action, desire takes many forms, but the most powerful of all is the vital self's craving or seeking after the fruit of our works. Phalam. Gita chapter 2, 47. The fruit we covet may be a reward of internal pleasure. It may be the accomplishment of some preferred idea or some cherished will, or the satisfaction of the egoistic emotions, or else the pride of success of our highest hopes and ambitions. Or it may be an external reward, a recompense entirely material. Wealth, position, honor, victory, good fortune, or any other fulfillment of vital or physical desire. But all alike are lures by which egoism holds us. Always, these satisfactions delude us with the sense of mastery and the idea of freedom, while really we are harnessed and guided or ridden and whipped by some gross or subtle, some noble or ignoble figure of the blind desire that drives the world. Therefore, the first rule of action laid down by the Gita is to do the work that should be done without any desire for the fruit, nishkama karma. So, desire is a motive power that drives the cosmos. It is an energy based in prana, meant to go out and find an object and fulfill itself in the acquisition, the conquest of that object. That is how it's felt through us. We desire something and we go and get it. Nishkama karma, by the way, is not a phrase that occurs anywhere in the Gita, but it's a handy philosophy. Nishkama, without desire, karma, works. So desireless works is what it means. A simple rule in appearance, and yet how difficult to carry out with anything like an absolute sincerity and liberating entireness. In the greater part of our action, we use the principle very little, if at all, and then even mostly as a sort of counterpoise to the normal principle of desire, or and to mitigate the extreme action of that tyrant impulse. At best, we are satisfied if we arrive at a modified and disciplined egoism, not too shocking to our moral sense, not too brutally offensive to others. And to our partial self-discipline, we give various names and forms. We habituate ourselves by practice to the sense of duty, to a firm fidelity to principle, a stoical fortitude or a religious resignation, a quiet or an ecstatic submission to God's will. But it is not these things that the Gita intends, useful though they are in their place. It aims at something absolute, unmitigated, uncompromising, a turn, an attitude that will change the whole poise of the soul. Not the mind's control of vital impulse is its rule, but the strong immobility of an immortal spirit. So we can see, as we trace it out, both in the Katha Upanishad, which has a deep link to the Bhagavad Gita, and in the Gita itself, that it acknowledges that there are stages of advance. And we begin by not claiming the fruit of the action, and by diminishing the prominence of the ego that action is done more and more in consecration, more and more as an offering, and the ego attenuates happily. Doesn't mean it disappears altogether. Getting it out of the way right from the start is likely as not impossible for virtually every human being. But our aim is this eternal status housed in the real self, which is one with the divine being. And the Gita is absolute in insisting that this is achievable here in life. We don't have to quit the world to get there. The test it lays down is an absolute equality of the mind and the heart to all results, to all reactions, to all happenings. This is recorded again in the second chapter in a whole string of verses, shlokas, from 55 to 61, and really it goes on beyond that, virtually to the end of the chapter, which is the chapter most focusing on the nature of spiritual work. If good fortune and ill fortune, if respect and insult, if reputation and obloquy, if victory and defeat, if pleasant event and sorrowful event leave us not only unshaken but untouched, free in the emotions, free in the nervous reactions, free in the mental view, not responding with the least disturbance or vibration in any spot of the nature, then we have the absolute liberation to which the Gita points us, but not otherwise. The tiniest reaction is a proof that the discipline is imperfect and that some part of us accepts ignorance and bondage as its law and clings still to the old nature. Our self-conquest is only partially accomplished. It is still imperfect or unreal in some stretch or part or smallest spot of the ground of our nature. And that little pebble of imperfection may throw down the whole achievement of the yoga. Exclamation point. So again, let's go back to the Gita's assurance that it is possible to achieve this perfect stability in conscious awareness in the midst of action, enjoying the world, but free from that enjoyment, with all things offered, nothing claimed, still and silent in the spirit, but poised energetically, ready to act when the divine will bids us do so. There are certain semblances of an equal spirit, which must not be mistaken for the profound and vast spiritual equality which the Gita teaches. That equality, we say, is samatha or samatvam. There are a string of things which, in a sense, are preparations for that greater state. Here he goes. There is an equality of disappointed resignation, an equality of pride, an equality of hardness and indifference. All these are egoistic in their nature. Inevitably, they come in the course of the sadhana, but they must be rejected or transformed into the true quietude. Rejected or transformed. So even though they are victories over the old nature, even though they have imposed a discipline, a stoic command of the nature, and one does not flinch in the face of anything, yet it is a plateau, it is a way station on a longer highway, it has to be abandoned. We have to be willing and ready to give up even the states of realization, not only the works that we offer continually, but any state of awakening, any state of relative enlightenment that is not the final enlightenment, we must be willing to pour back into the fire. Finally, one is that fire in that permanent state of wakefulness. There is, too, on a higher level, the equality of the Stoic, the equality of a devout resignation or a sage detachment, the equality of a soul aloof from the world and indifferent to its doings. These, too, are insufficient. First approaches they can be, but they are at most early soul phases only, or imperfect mental preparations for our entry into the true and absolute self-existent wide evenness of the spirit. True, based on real being, sat. Self-existent, does not lean on anything else for its support. Wide, vast in being and station, not limited like the ego is limited to space and time. Evenness, again, samatha. All is the same to it, sama. For it is certain that so great a result cannot be arrived at immediately and without any previous stages. At first, we have to learn to bear the shocks of the world with the central part of our being untouched and silent, even when the surface mind, heart, life are strongly shaken. Unmoved there on the bedrock of our life, we must separate the soul watching behind or immune deep within from these outer workings of our nature. So gaining an equipoise inside, even if we find that the mind is restless in the face of these contacts which are dangerous, which are threatening, or thrilling, or alluring, and so too go the passions in pursuit or running in fear from them, still, if there is something in us which is still in watching, that itself is a signal victory. To be able to be stationed then in that, however the mind or the vitality or even the body tremble, is a step forward beyond price, because it leads to greater liberations later. One becomes deeply seated in that poise of the Purusha, that conscious witness soul power, which sees itself as separate from nature. That I have that, but I am not that. I am in command of this mind, this life, and this body, but I am not that. Or I am not that only. I lend the integration of my soul into this equipment of nature so that something can be done, fulfilling the divine purpose in the cosmos. And this would be Gita, again, the second chapter in the 65th shloka. Afterwards, extending this calm and steadfastness of the detached soul to its instruments, it will become slowly possible to radiate peace from the luminous center to the darker peripheries. You see, here we go. There is no absolute gulf or separation between Purusha and Prakriti. To Sri Aurobindo, all is one. They are polarities of the larger being. And one takes that first calm and pushes it into the rest of nature. That is a dynamic state. That peace can be dynamic and not simply absence of action. It is something positive. And peace, felicitating the mind and the heart and the physicality, uplifts them and makes them plastic and luminous and ready for a still greater light to come. But first, this stability, this equipoise, must be achieved. In this process, we may take the passing help of many minor phases, a certain stoicism, a certain calm philosophy, a certain religious exaltation may help us towards some nearness to our aim, or we may call in even less strong and exalted, but still useful powers of our mental nature. So, we have to recognize that there are attributes, there are powers that exist in the higher realms of the mental region, which can come cascading down into us. We call them, even if we haven't the power yet to summon the spiritual force itself. We can seek and entice the descent of these higher altitudes of the mind to come down into us, to bathe the body and uplift the heart and bring lucidity to the mind, to the lower ranges of the mind. The higher mind is a new territory, and yet it can come. But how then shall we continue? Oh, did I read that? In the end, we must either discard or transform them and arrive instead at an entire equality, a perfect self-existent peace within, and even if we can, a total, unassailable, self-poised, and spontaneous delight in all our members. Samatvam yoga uchyate. Equality is called yoga. The 47th shloka. But how then shall we continue to act at all? For ordinarily, the human being acts because he has a desire or feels a mental, vital, or physical want or need. He is driven by the necessities of the body, by the lust of riches, honors, or fame, or by a craving for the personal satisfactions of the mind or the heart, or a craving for power or pleasure. Or he is seized and pushed about by a moral need, or at least the need or the desire of making his ideas or his ideals or his will or his party or his country or his gods prevail in the world. So there's the gratification of the appetites, and then there's the great civic interests, which are also the field of desire and egoistic action. Can we bring perfection there? If none of these desires, nor any other, must be the spring of our action, it would seem as if all incentive or motive power had been removed and action itself must necessarily cease. Remember Sri Aurobindo's position. He's writing from a standpoint of a double enlightenment. The first, the experience of Brahmic Nirvana, which is, of course, a term that occurs in the Gita. But it's an elimination of the ego and a recognition of only that as the reality. And yet, in the midst of that first grand realization, which never left him, he continued to act in the political sphere. He had no ends to achieve personally. He wasn't looking for fame as a professor or teacher or later, when he got into political life as a political leader, didn't really want to become a leader, liked to instead direct things from behind the scenes to form and fashion ideas, which then he could press into service, into action through other capable, vitally gifted, intellectually brilliant compatriots of his. But at some point, he had to come into it himself. But by then, already he is in this spiritual consciousness. So he is leading, but without personal motive. He writes here, not from the idea of what is possible, but from what is the certainty of his experience. The Gita replies with its third great secret of the divine life. All action must be done in a more and more Godward and finally a God-possessed consciousness. Our works must be a sacrifice to the divine, and in the end, a surrender of all our being, mind, will, heart, sense, life, and body to the one must make God love and God's service our only motive. This gets, of course, articulated towards the end of the Gita. This transformation of the motive force and very character of works is indeed its master idea. It is the foundation of its unique synthesis of works, love, and knowledge. In the end, not desire, but the consciously felt will of the eternal remains as the sole driver of our action and the sole originator of its initiative. Well, obviously, chapter 18, verse 61, shloka 61, speaks to that. Equality. Renunciation of all desire for the fruit of our works, action done as a sacrifice to the Supreme Lord of our nature and of all nature. These are the three first Godward approaches in the Gita's way of Karma Yoga. Well, it continues because now we've reached the end of the third chapter. Next time we begin the fourth chapter, the sacrifice, the triune path, and the Lord of the sacrifice. So we continue to be in the Gita. And remember, we're many, many months away in 1914, 1915, from getting to when he launches his essays on the Gita in 1916. But here we get some preliminary glimpses as the foundation of an approach to a synthetic yoga through work. Necessarily, we continue to work. Equality, Samatvam, chapter 2, 47. Renunciation of all desire for the fruit of our works, Palam Tyaktva, chapter 2, shloka 51. Action done as a sacrifice to the Supreme Lord to get the Divine's blessing and to please the Supreme. Bhoktaram Yajna Tapasam. Chapter 5, Shloka 29. All actions, Sarva Karmani, lodged in me, all the time you take in your refuge in me, your ashrayam, you attain the eternal, the indestructible state. And that's the final chapter, 18, in shloka 56. There are so many fine verses along the way, like 3, 9, 17, 25, and obviously chapter 4, verses 23 through 25, which includes the famous one, Brahmar Panam Brahma Havi. All of this resonates in this great teaching. So we leave it for greater examination next time. Let's see if we can find an appropriate section in Savitri to match well with this. So this is in Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, Canto 1, The Pursuit of the Unknowable. This should be around page 305 in your book. All is too little that the world can give. Its power and knowledge are the gifts of time and cannot fill the spirit's sacred thirst. Although of one these forms of greatness are, and by its breath of grace our lives abide, although more near to us than nearness self, it is some utter truth of what we are. Hidden by its own works, it seemed far off, impenetrable, occult, voiceless, obscure. The presence was lost by which all things have charm, the glory lacked of which they are dim signs. The world lived on, made empty of its cause, like love when the beloved's face is gone. The labor to know seemed a vain strife of mind. All knowledge ended in the unknowable. The effort to rule seemed a vain pride of will, a trivial achievement scorned by time. All power retired into the omnipotent. A cave of darkness guards the eternal light. A silence settled on his striving heart. Absolved from the voices of the world's desire, he turned to the ineffable's timeless call. A being intimate and unnameable, a wide compelling ecstasy and peace, felt in himself and all, and yet ungrasped, approached and faded from his soul's pursuit, as if forever luring him beyond. Near it retreated, far it called him still. Nothing could satisfy but its delight. Its absence left the greatest actions dull. Its presence made the smallest seem divine. When it was there, the heart's abyss was filled. But when the uplifting deity withdrew, existence lost its aim in the inane. The order of the immemorial planes, the godlike fullness of the instruments, were turned to props for an impermanent scene. But who that mightiness was, he knew not yet. Impalpable, yet filling all that is, it made and blotted out a million worlds and took and lost a thousand shapes and names. It wore the guise of an indiscernible vast, or was a subtle kernel in the soul. A distant greatness left it huge and dim. A mystic closeness shut it sweetly in. It seemed sometimes a figment or a robe, and seemed sometimes his own colossal shade. A giant doubt overshadowed his advance. Across a neutral, all-supporting void, whose blankness nursed his lone immortal spirit, allured towards some recondite supreme, aided, coerced by enigmatic powers, aspiring and half-sinking and upborn, invincibly he ascended without pause. Always a signless, vague immensity brooded without approach, beyond response, condemning finite things to nothingness, fronting him with the incommensurable. Then to the ascent there came a mighty term. A height was reached where nothing made could live. a line where every hope and search must cease, neared some intolerant, bare reality, a zero formed, pregnant with boundless change. On a dizzy verge, where all disguises fail, and human mind must abdicate in light, or die like a moth in the naked blaze of truth, he stood compelled to a tremendous choice. All he had been, and all towards which he grew, must now be left behind or else transform into a self of that which has no name. A grand place to pause. So, namaste. Jai Ma.